From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. Universities teach all kinds of writing: technical, science, creative fiction. Now there's a textbook for another kind of literature: comics. Really. It's called Drawing Words and Writing Pictures, a definitive course from concept to comic in 15 lessons. Jessica Abel and Matt Madden are the cartoonists who wrote the new textbook. They join me from WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks very much for coming in. Hi.
Hi.
So a textbook for comics?
That's right.
Absolutely.
Why did you write it?
Well, we've been teaching comics for 7 years, and we've gone through several sort of iterations, generations of students, and a lot of the stuff that's in the textbook comes out of our teaching, and it also comes out of an understanding and awareness as we've been around the country doing talks about various comics that we've done, that there's just a real hunger for information about comics and how do you make comics. They're very complicated, you know, it's very difficult to do. It's not just something you can sit down and figure out intuitively very quickly. I mean, you can do it, but it takes a long time.
That's how Jessica and I learned, was the very long, and the way most cartoonists do learn, and probably many will continue to learn, is this very slow catch-as-catch-can process of picking things up piecemeal and learning through trial and error. So we're trying to speed that process up a little bit.
Yeah, my very first thought was, oh, I can't draw. So I'm not going to be any good at making a comic.
But then I hope you turn to page 6.
I did.
Or was it
page 9.
Page 9. I opened the book and can't draw, read this. And there are several really great examples of comics that, you know, one is made entirely of little dots. And it's very effective. So I guess you don't have to draw.
Right. It's not to downplay the importance of art and drawing in comics, because obviously they're crucial, but it's more that there's a wide range of ways that you can approach telling stories visually. I think a lot of people are so intimidated when they see this, you know, elaborately illustrated work that they think, oh, I could never do that. But that's just one kind of comics.
I love in the opening part of the book, the welcome that you guys have drawn. It shows the two of you and you're walking through a series of panels as the characters that will appear later in the book are preparing to come onto the stage. So you've got this guy, Nate. This is you, Matt Madden, saying, Nate, you're on in about 10 pages. And he's stretching, limbering up. To get ready to come into the book. But what occurred to me while I was looking at the book and looking at this series of panels is that there's timing in comics, isn't there?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, a lot of it is about pacing and rhythm.
If you look at the intro comic, for example, you'll see that the first panel is quite quick, and it's we just say who we are. Hi, I'm Jessica. And I'm Matt. And then the next panel is a little bit wider. And that's where you see Nate on the floor stretching out. And that gives you a little bit of a pause. And then there's another panel that's a little bit narrower, and there's a giant whoosh and a bunch of motion lines coming down, which you read quite quickly. It points right at the next panel where the character who is whooshing by has landed.
There are all these other little lines and squiggles and, you know, like when a character has like little sweat beads kind of jumping off their heads, or like a squiggle over their heads to show that they're kind of like annoyed or put out. What are those?
We actually have a name for those, which we borrowed from the cartoonist Mort Walker, the guy who did Beetle Bailey. He coined a term emanata, things that emanate. And he meant it very tongue-in-cheek. And in fact, he went through and cataloged all of these things. So the flying sweat beads are known as pludes, P-L-E-W-D-S, pludes.
Which is not to say we don't call them pludes.
Right, so he actually classified them all, and he has an extensive list of names, like briffets for speed lines. I forget what. They're, you know, all kinds of silly names. So we didn't take the whole hog like that. But the notion of having a term to describe these kind of emotional markers in comics is very useful, because they're part of the comics language and something that's very unique to comics.
They're non-literal pictorial elements that express something narrative.
And, you know, very often they're thought of as a very silly kind of thing, the same way the pow sound effects are. But in the right hands and with like a little bit of thought about them, they can also be very subtle storytelling tools. It's a matter of finding a range of things that you can do with the narrative tools that comics use.
You guys are pretty serious about the funny pages.
Yeah,
well, if you've ever read our comics, they're pretty serious too, actually, I have to say. But we don't mean to take all the fun out of this. And I really think that actually this doesn't take all the fun out of it. If you're into comics and you're drawing the stuff, even though we're treating it in a very serious way, you know, many of our students use all of these tools to do really funny stuff.
Jessica Abel and Matt Madden are co-authors of the new comic textbook, Drawing Words and Writing Pictures, a definitive course from concept to comic in 15 lessons. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
One thing the internet has done in China, it's freed many young writers to post their literary efforts online. Under the Communist Party, authors had to penetrate a maze of loyal party members to get a book published. In this final in our series about the internet's impact on Chinese arts and culture, NPR's Laura Seidel talks about novels.
Back in the days when Mao Zedong was still running China, literature was supposed to be in the service of workers, peasants, and soldiers. But there was underground literature that people passed around in bound notebooks.
It was very dangerous to copy them and to pass them around. You could get in trouble if you got caught with them.
That's Princeton University East Asian Studies professor Perry Link. If you're thinking that those notebooks were filled with the writings of a Chinese Solzhenitsyn criticizing the Communist Party, you would be wrong.
They were almost all this kind of entertainment fiction, triangular love stories and detective stories and things like that.
People wanted that kind of pulp fiction, but what made it through the government censors and into bookstores was often dry and boring, and always had to have a message about the improvement of communist society. But now writer Fu Tian, that's her pen name, is not thinking about how to make a better China. The pale afternoon sun filters through a dusty window in her Shanghai apartment. It lights up her mischievous face as she types. All she wants is to entertain her readers. Fu, whose real name is Zhang Shuyu, writes historical fiction. Her latest book is filled with romance and palace intrigue.
The story is based on Wu Zetian, the only female emperor in Chinese history. In my book, there is a little girl who is like one of the daughters of the female emperor. In real history, the princess did not succeed in getting power, but in this novel, she does.
Here's a short segment from the beginning of her book.
Although the carriage was moving smoothly, Su Cui felt restless inside. It was the first time she had ever left her hometown. She had spent the previous 8 years of her life in a small town living with her aunt and uncle. The couple had shown her a picture of her father, saying that he was a well-known warrior. They didn't tell her anything about her mother. But a few days ago, a visitor came in a hurry and said that her mother wanted her to go to the capital city.
Fu has been writing novels exclusively for the internet for over a year. She now has thousands of loyal readers. They come to find her stories on a website called Chidian. It's so successful that 70 people now work at its offices.
Wei.
Sitting in rows and rows of cubicles, editors sort through the thousands of submissions posted on the site every month. They're trying to figure out what's going to be popular and move it up to the front page. Fu Tian is so popular, she gets health benefits and a base salary from Chidian. Wu Wenhui, one of the site's founders, says Chidian gets about 200 million page views a day and is one of China's most popular literary sites. He says Fu Tian quickly drew the attention of readers and editors because she is funny and fun. Her fans must pay 2 cents to read each new installment of her novels, and Fu gets a cut. Manager Wu admits this model doesn't always lead to the most literary fiction. He says on the internet, writing is focused on plot, writers and chapters on cliffhangers to keep readers' attention, and there isn't much focus on grammar and style. Joe Lusby, the general manager of Penguin Books in China, thinks online lit is in its infancy and is likely to get better as it matures.
I think it's very young. I think the writers themselves are extremely young. This is young people writing for young people.
And there is some good news for those people who like actual books made of paper. Fu Tian and her internet colleagues still want to see their writing in print, and publishers are looking to the internet to find young talent. I take a visit with Fu to Shanghai City of Books. It takes up 6 stories of a high-rise downtown.
So where is your favorite section of the bookstore?
Let me look for it.
Fu Tian has been coming here since she was a teenager. As she strolls through the aisles, the books that catch her eye are often by other internet writers.
The Ghost Blows Out the Light. That used to be the greatest hit on Shidan website, and it's being made into a movie.
Do you hope that happens to you, that it gets made into a movie?
Of course.
Fu's very excited that she will have a real live paper book you can buy in a bookstore coming out this fall. While she's elated by the freedom and the opportunity that the internet is bringing to her and other young Chinese writers, she admits there are limits.
We have greater freedom than writers who work in the traditional publishing system, but it is still not like you can write about anything.
Like, meaning what? Not anything.
You need to do positive things, if we can put it this way.
Fu cannot write about political topics such as Taiwan or Tibet. She and other young writers on the internet can be as entertaining as they want with their cliffhangers, romances, and historical fantasies. They just can't write about anything too serious or politically sensitive. For them, the internet is the great entertainment highway.
And that's NPR's Laura Seidel, who has recently returned from China. And Laura joins us now. And, okay, I'm just hearing entertaining, that's okay, but you can't talk politics. What does this add up to, the communist government allowing more artistic freedom now than in the past?
The communist government is allowing more artistic freedom because I think, in part, the government wants to promote creativity. But I came away from China with really mixed feelings about how much the internet was really opening up the culture. Certainly, it's been a wonderful thing for many creative people. They can be entertaining in a way they couldn't in the past. But when it comes to certain topics, they're still intimidated.
This, although, could change over time because it isn't really possible to control the internet. I mean, it's too big. You've pointed out in one of your earlier stories that the Chinese government hasn't been able to stop something they would like to stop, which is pirated music and movies, because they come through on the internet.
Right, but they work a lot harder to clamp down on the political topics. You know, the four biggies, Taiwan, Tibet, Tiananmen Square, or Falun Gong. If you post something about that, the likelihood is it's going to get taken down. And it's a big open question as to whether or not artists will ever be able to get political.
200 million Chinese online now, but it's just a fraction of the population of China. How fast is access growing?
Well, I think one thing that it's important to understand is that 200 million or so Chinese are the elite. These are the people who are benefiting most from the economic changes in China. And so, therefore, right now, these are the people who are least likely to really protest politically. These are the people who want to write entertaining novels because they're thinking about their next job. As to how fast it will grow, that's not really clear. It is growing fast, and we'll see what kind of impact that actually has on the content as more of this population gets online.
Laura, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
NPR's Laura Seidel, she's been talking to us over the past days about her exploration of the impact of the internet on the arts and culture in China. And if you go to npr.org, you can hear the earlier stories in this series. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In Your Health, a profile of an 81-year-old karaoke performer who sings the praises of friendship. But first, we look at a Japanese inventor's unusual answer to a serious problem. People who live in nursing homes can suffer from loneliness, boredom, and social isolation. Some nursing homes are turning to a fuzzy little robot to fix the problem. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
Anyone who's ever loved a dog or a cat knows how much an animal companion can bring to a person's life. But lots of retirement homes don't allow them. For example, pets can only visit at Vincent Hall's Arleigh Burke Pavilion in McLean, Virginia. But this retirement community does offer its residents something else. A nurse is holding what looks like a kid's stuffed animal. It's a baby seal. A robot baby seal. I watch as an aide helps Virginia Long use a walker to slowly come into the activity room. When she sits down, the nurse puts the seal on her lap. It's named Ollie. The robot sort of quivers as Virginia Long talks to it.
What are you shivering for? Are you cold? Yes. Okay.
I can't tell when Ollie is happy and not happy.
Either. Are you happy? Are you happy, Ollie?
The seal has soft white fur and big black eyes. As Virginia Long strokes it, the eyes open and close. You don't think it's strange to have a seal for a pet?
Well, it's odd, yes. But a lot of people have odd animals.
Later, as other people come in for bingo, I asked her why she likes the robot.
because it's alive and you can work with it. Pet it, rub it.
Do you have a pet now?
I did, but I don't now. I had a cat. But somebody stole him.
This seal has been available in Japan for several years under the brand name Paro. The robots sell for a few thousand bucks. Now, a new company in Florida plans to bring the seal to the U.S. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing depends on who you ask. The inventor thinks it's a good thing. Takanori Shibata works at Japan's National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology. He built the seal to explore how people can make emotional connections to robots. He says he tried robotic cats and dogs, but people didn't find those convincing.
When I asked the people to evaluate cat robot or dog robot, they expected too much, and they became critical to the robot.
But people have no idea what a baby seal is supposed to do. So even though the robot can't walk or play games, they just think it's cute. Look at an X-ray, though, and the cuteness disappears. The robot has seriously high-tech innards, little motors, computer chips, and sensors for sound, light, and touch.
And when people stroke Paro, Paro feels good. And the whiskers are also sensors. So Paro responds to my touch.
So he doesn't like that?
No, he doesn't like it.
So if you touch his whiskers, he just sort of makes a sound and moves his head away?
Yeah.
Shibata says people have done scientific studies showing that the seal can reduce stress and provide comfort to people in nursing homes. And there's a real market for that.
I've kind of gotten attached to her, and I can see how people can get attached to her. I treat her like she's real.
That's Nancy Chilla. She's head of nursing at the Arleigh Burke Pavilion. She says they first got the robot in April to test it with about a dozen residents.
If I walk down the hall, groups of people will stop. Residents will wave to have Ollie come over. And they actually remember her now when she comes out.
When they're interacting with Ollie, are they aware that Ollie is a robot?
They are. They have said that they're aware that she's a robot, but they love her just the same.
Well, not everybody. Chilla says one person was very agitated. But in general, this retirement community is enthusiastic. What would be the advantage of this over just, say, a cat?
Well, when I go home, I plug Ollie into the charger and turn him off, and I leave for the weekend. Whereas a cat, you have to feed, you have to have a litter box, you have to take to the vet. Ollie just goes to sleep, and we don't have to worry about her until Monday.
There's no need to worry because the robot is not alive. And some people say that's actually the problem.
One of the things that we've learned is that it is the unexpected and spontaneous behavior of the living creature that adds so much of the value to people's experience.
Bill Thomas is a physician and professor of aging studies at the Erickson School at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He says nursing homes can accommodate pets if they want to. In fact, he pioneered a reform movement in elder care called the Eden Alternative. It involves filling older people's homes with lots of animals, plants, and children.
I can say with confidence that people in that reform movement really are not looking for a robot to solve our problems.
Even though if people are lonely and bored, he says almost any kind of novelty can get their attention.
I have no doubt that I could thrill a group of older people with a fur-covered robot. I know I can. But it doesn't solve anything. It doesn't solve the problem that is really causing their distress and their lack of enjoyment of life.
He says, sure, caring for other living creatures takes work. It can sometimes be a hassle. But it also gives people a real emotional connection. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You can see a video of the baby seal robot on our website, npr.org. Back when Americans were listening to Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles, China's airwaves were full of songs with lyrics from Chairman Mao's Little Red Book. Things have loosened up a bit since then, but China's government still bans music that mentions sex, violence, or has low-class humor. That rules out a good chunk of the Ryan Seacrest Top 40. Turn on the radio in China today, and you're most likely to hear something like this. Yeah. Well, now the internet has given Chinese music fans free access to pretty much everything. As part of our series on the effect of the internet on Chinese arts and culture, NPR's Laura Seidel has this profile of an independent musician using the internet to make a name for himself.
V6 is eating a slice of pizza when he opens the door of his apartment.
Hi, I'm Laura.
V6.
Nice to meet you.
The 27-year-old electronic musician lives and works in a high-rise on the outskirts of the city. We sit down in his studio, and he explains it was the internet that really allowed him to explore his passion for electronic music.
While I was in high school, I used to listen to rock and roll music. It was very hard to get foreign or Western music. You had to go to the black market to get CDs.
But when B6 got access to the internet in 1999, it opened up a whole new world.
We used those peer-to-peer websites like Napster to download music.
B6 fell in love with electronic music such as techno and intelligent dance music out of Detroit, Michigan. Now his own compositions range from dance music to the contemplative. This is a piece he calls My Post-Rock Yard. It's about the small and somewhat disheveled garden outside the window of his studio.
People misunderstand electronic music. Electronic music does not necessarily have to be cold. It can be very human, and even warmer than acoustic music.
Not only is the internet helping B6 find new music, it's helping him make a living from his work. Until recently, musicians who weren't officially sanctioned by the government couldn't sell CDs or get airplay. But now the market has opened up.
Sometimes I sell some of my own CDs, and sometimes I help do soundtracks for commercials and movies. And sometimes I do soundtracks for installation art at galleries.
B6 knows it's rare to be able to make a living from your music in China, and he wants to help other independent musicians support themselves. So a couple of years ago, he became one of the founders of a website called Neocha. He and co-founder Sean Liao wanted to figure out a way for independent musicians to make money. But Liao says they didn't know what it was.
Necessity is the mother of invention, in that Chinese musicians and Chinese labels and everybody that's in this industry is getting pushed so hard and trying to figure this model out that maybe they'll come on a solution before someone in the U.S. does.
Neocha sells advertising and they split the revenue with the artists. They don't even bother trying to sell the music because there's so much piracy in China, there is no point. One way Neocha promotes the music is with an online music player called Next. Turn it on and you can listen to a random sampling of songs by Neocha musicians. Don't like that? Click the button that says Next and you get something else. Sean Liao says that what independent musicians in China need is a way to make a living with their music.
It's kind of a cyclical thing that we need to help them just get to a level where they can start making some money so that they can live out and achieve their creative potential.
The internet isn't just a way to help musicians make money, it's also a way for them to connect with each other. It's a Thursday night, and B6 is hopping on a packed train with three musicians from Japan. They're all heading to play a club in Nanjing, a gig they planned together online.
We have the internet, like MSN live message, so we can, get connected with all the musicians from all over the world.
2.5 hours later, they arrive in Nanjing and head to a smoky basement club called Castle Bar. It's packed with trendy-looking young Chinese and Westerners. It's a pastiche of brightly colored hair, cargo pants, blue jeans, and short skirts. B6 stands behind a glass window in the DJ booth. His MacBook is hooked into the sound system. The crowd looks on and then starts to move out to the dance floor. The club doesn't empty out until after 3 a.m. A couple of fans stop to talk with me, Johnny Ju and Yao Lian. They give the same answer when I asked them how they first heard electronic music.
On website.
你说是现在这种电子音乐还是... 通过internet.
B6 has his criticisms of the way the Communist Party still manages the media in his country, but he feels optimistic about the future. He says the government is trying to encourage creativity.
I know that in the minds of many foreigners, China is the world's factory. That is not the image the Chinese government would like to project to the world.
B6 says the government wants the Chinese people to be more creative, so he believes there will be more openings for independent artists like himself, especially as more young people explore what's on the internet. Here's a song by B6 about what he thinks the world will be like in 50 years. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Coming up tomorrow, Chinese novelists putting their writing online. They're applying new technology to an old Chinese tradition of underground writing. Back in the time of Mao, writers had to pass around notebooks with their handwritten novels.
It was very dangerous to copy them and to pass them around. You could get in trouble if you got caught with them.
Now, internet novelists get their readers to pay by the chapter, and some of them are breaking into traditional publishing.